This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, February 14th, 2022. I'm Caleb Brown. According to two U.S. senators, the CIA is engaged in holding sensitive data about Americans. It's not clear what data the CIA has, but it seems likely the agency has circumvented laws meant to proscribe the collection and storing of information about Americans. Cato's Patrick Eddington and Julian Sanchez comment. Pat, I want to start with you. What have you been asking the federal government for with respect to information about data collection about Americans?
Well, in the context of the organization we're going to discuss this morning, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, at Cato, we submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to the PCLOB a few years back, looking essentially to get some of these reports that they had alluded to publicly, but had never released on this thing called Executive Order 12333, which is probably best thought of as the kind of day-to-day operating guide for U.S. intelligence community components. And we essentially got stiff-armed by the PCLOB, which of course led to our lawsuit, which is ongoing. And what we were trying to get at essentially is, you know, who's hiding the ball here, and what is this really all about? What is happening essentially under this broad executive order that's been in place for over 40 years now that may implicate the privacy and civil liberties of Americans? And so, you know, we have a little bit of a better idea now, as Julian, I think, will get into in much more detail here in a couple of minutes, about at least one of those reports that we've been seeking.
All right, Julian, what has been declassified here and what do we know now that we didn't know a couple of days ago?
Well, not a whole lot, frankly. Senators Wyden and Heinrich had requested declassification of a letter they sent to the CIA concerning a bulk collection program that had been the subject of a Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board so-called deep dive analysis. And so it was declassified was their own letter, along with some not terribly informative fragments of the PCLOB's output, including staff recommendations regarding this bulk collection program. Wyden and Heinrich, as Wyden is often fond of doing, however, have sort of given us some hints in that letter as to the nature of this. So all that's really public now is that there is some such program that is conducted pursuant to Executive Order 12333, this is issued initially by President Reagan in 1981, and which is the sort of the background, the backdrop charter governing intelligence activities by the American intelligence community. It's sort of what applies when more specific legislation like FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, doesn't cover a particular type of intelligence activity. So if Congress has not spoken, 12333 is sort of the fallback, both sort of authority and limitation on intelligence collection. And so they suggest that this is a program that involves collection of and querying of records for some kind of information about Americans. But why didn't Heinrich add that it's something that Americans would think had been restricted, or the kind of thing that had been, that would have been covered by recent reforms to FISA? This is a reference to the USA Freedom Act, which was passed in response to the disclosures by Edward Snowden of bulk telephone record collection by the NSA. So Wyden and Heinrich are essentially saying this is the type of bulk collection program that you know, an ordinary American might think Congress had already put limits on via these legislative reforms that passed post-Snowden. So I don't think it's a very great leap from there to think, well, it sounds then like he's probably talking about a bulk collection program that involves some kind of either telephone or telecommunication records. And so, you know, again, reading between the lines a little bit, it seems very likely that this involves the exploitation of a loophole in federal privacy law we've known about for quite a while. And indeed, way back in 2013, the New York Times had reported the CIA and other agencies were indeed exploiting to do large-scale collection of telephone records. And really, there are two potential loopholes here, right? One is the federal privacy law, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986, briefly put, right, prohibits telecommunications providers from disclosing to anyone, with limited exceptions, the contents of their customers' communications, but also prohibits those companies from disclosing to a government entity, like a law enforcement or intelligence agency, communications metadata, things like, you know, phone or internet records, without legal process, right? So the idea is, if they're providing this information, you know, to another private entity that they might have a contractual relationship with, that's one thing. But if they're going to be providing it to a law enforcement or intelligence agency, those agencies are supposed to go through a legal process to obtain such information, except two loopholes. One is, this limitation on disclosure to the government is binding on essentially communications service providers to the public. So if they provide that data to another entity that they're allowed to, and that entity isn't a communications service provider, the law doesn't say that that entity can't then turn around and give or sell the information to the government. This is something that Wyden, among others, have criticized and responded to with a proposed bill called the Fourth Amendment Is Not for Sale Act that would restrict government purchase of data that it would otherwise need to get legal process to obtain. And the other loophole is a carve out in 18 U.S.C. 2511F, subsection 2. It says, look, all these regulations about how the government can obtain these records, but none of these rules should be interpreted to limit the collection of the acquisition of foreign intelligence by means other than electronic surveillance as defined by FISA. So FISA is the law that provides the exclusive means for government and government intelligence agencies to do electronic surveillance. Wiretapping, that sort of thing. But getting records of, for example, phone bills or other kinds of internet information doesn't necessarily count as electronic surveillance as it's defined in that law, right? If they're not intercepting a communication, but just saying, hey, we want the phone records you store for your own purposes, the definition of electronic surveillance in FISA doesn't cover that. So what the law essentially says there is, look, we've got all these elaborate rules that look like they limit what the government can do, but there's this category of stuff that falls between the cracks, at least, I should say, to the extent that it concerns international or foreign communications or foreign communication systems. So essentially what they're saying here is, look, all of these elaborate rules and all of these processes, they don't apply if it's an international communication, so one end at least overseas, and you should note here, right, with internet communications and many other kinds of modern communications, right, you might have a communication with many participants. It would really only take one overseas to make the communication international, and it doesn't fall within the definition of electronic surveillance. A lot of metadata collection wouldn't fall within that definition. The law doesn't govern that, so that's a kind of gap in the regulation. And in those cases, really, they fall back on 12333, right, which is the authority that exists when more specific legislation doesn't spell out what the intelligence agencies have to do. And that's, I think, sort of a problem, right, because like water, government spying tends to take the path of least resistance. And so since the expiration of several Patriot Act authorities, we've gotten the sense through remarks by legislators that perhaps the Intelligence Committee had found ways to supplement these lapsed authorities that Congress had failed to reauthorize using authorities under Executive Order 12333. And, I think intuitively, this is not how it ought to work, that when an intelligence authority, a surveillance authority that Congress has passed, does not get renewed. And when the public in general tends to believe that a certain category of surveillance activity is, fairly, reasonably regulated by this whole panoply of statutory frameworks, well, the intelligence community shouldn't be looking for loopholes and alternate authorities that evade those restrictions and re-arrogate to themselves authorities Congress has chosen not to renew.
Yeah, this is a bit of a dark joke, but I think I've heard it said that whenever an intelligence agency stops complaining about powers or technical abilities that it doesn't have, that's perhaps the time to worry most.
Yeah, it's not a bad rule of thumb.
Pat?
I think it's important also to kind of emphasize here that this particular report we're discussing today deals with financial-related information, which I think should be of deep concern to anybody, for example, who, let's say, contributes money overseas, let's say to Arab or Muslim charities, in which the intelligence community, and in this case, the Central Intelligence Agency, has a particular interest, right? It's that kind of modality, essentially, that led to this debacle of the Holy Land Foundation trial, you know, well over a decade ago. A trial, by the way, that most people consider to be an absolute travesty. And I think if we look actually at what the report itself says, to the extent that we can actually see anything that isn't blacked out.
And we should, just to be clear, there are two separate programs, right, that the mm-hmm. the board investigated. One of them we don't really know anything about, but I'm betting it's probably a telecommunications records program. And there's a second program that involves financial data that Pat is now talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so when we kind of look at what the board had to say there on the financial data one, it's really clear that they are playing fast and loose with how they essentially allegedly protect the data of Americans. You know, it's important to remember here that there is no actual external oversight that's taking place here. The CIA is making all these decisions about how they're going to store the data, how long they're going to store it. In some cases, they allegedly have to destroy some types of data after 5 years. In some cases, they're allowed to keep data for up to 25 years. And we also know that there have been what appears to be an extremely large number of unmasking requests with respect to U.S. persons. And when I say a large number, we're guessing a little bit, but if you look at the redacted section where the attorney at the CIA they were dealing with is discussing this, that individual's ballpark estimate is redacted in such a way that at least 8 to 10 characters have been redacted. Well, you can kind of step back and begin to do the math in your head. It could be a very large number of folks who are having essentially their identities unmasked. And I would find it difficult to believe, candidly, that, let's say, 100,000 Americans are necessarily engaged in sending money to ISIS or other Salafist organizations. I'd find that really tough to believe. So it raises questions about the scope of the collection. It raises questions about, at least in my mind, how did it get started? Who authorized this? Did this get started under Bush 43 or did it get started under Obama? We don't know. We know that the PCLOB staff met with CIA about this multiple times between November of 2015 and August of 2016. But those were, you know, staff presentations essentially by CIA. Again, CIA controlling the data. There's an algorithm that's involved, at least one algorithm that they're using. Nobody has any idea. No idea about the code. No idea how reliable it is. No external vetting of that, I'm willing to bet. So an awful lot, again, inside this black box that has barely been penetrated by this release today. And of course, you know, Julian mentioned the other report, which at this stage of the game, we know nothing about, but that we at Cato are in court trying to litigate to get it out for the public.
And Julian, you mentioned in a podcast that we just recorded just a few days ago that there are federal agencies already. There are members of Congress who seem to think that a whole lot of data, because it exists, the government ought to have access to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is an unfortunate side effect of a world in which, as a kind of default byproduct of network communications and computing devices with sensors on them being pretty ubiquitous, a lot of structured data is generated by default. And because the price of data storage has dropped off a cliff over the last few decades, it's sort of cheaper to store data than to erase it. And so you know, whereas I think, you know, in a previous era, maybe if someone had said, hey, we should be collecting a lot of information about every location people go to and every, you know, news article everyone reads, you would say, my God, that's terrifying. And why would you propose that? But when the data is automatically generated as a byproduct of these kind of ordinary activities as a function of how, you know, the internet and other technologies work, then it starts to seem like, you know, in the view of many people, at least, a kind of, you know, perverse, willful blindness not to exploit it. Why would you not, make maximum use of all this information if there's some prospect that this could be used for intelligence or law enforcement purposes? I will note, ironically, one of the very few things that comes out of the very limited disclosures we've just seen is that this does not seem to be an approach that the intelligence community is really taking to its own processes, by which I mean one thing that's mentioned with respect to these programs is, okay, the system has some way of determining when a query against these bulk collected records appears to concern a U.S. person. Which would make sense if you're talking about phone or internet records. If this is a U.S. phone number or ISP, the system could easily detect that and say, hey, it looks like you're, you know, like Clippy, see, you know, spy Clippy pops up and says, hey, it looks like you're looking for U.S. person information. And it sort of reminds them that you need to have a legitimate foreign intelligence purpose under 12333 in order to go looking at this information. But that's it. It's just like a, you know, okay. What it doesn't do, and this was one of the recommendations the PCLOB staff made, was, hey, you know, if you want to do oversight of this after the fact, if you want to make it possible to actually review the CIA's conduct, and, you know, in the case that there are concerns raised about some of this maybe not being appropriate, wouldn't it make sense to ask them to document the foreign intelligence purpose when they're making queries against this database, so that if someone's trying to do oversight a few years later, you don't just have to look at, you know, these queries all happened, we have no idea why, let's hope someone remembers why they punched a search in 5 years ago, which is to say, right, they're making a design choice not to design their database system in a way that is friendly to oversight of their surveillance activity, even though they are very glad to exploit the robust data collection of various private entities in order to do oversight of all of the rest of us.
Patrick Eddington and Julian Sanchez are senior fellows at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and give a rating to the Cato Daily Podcast on your podcast platform of choice, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.